From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the president of one of Michigan's public universities talks about what a college education will look like this fall.
The structure and the flow of work, I think that will be significantly changed. I think the importance of higher education has actually significantly increased.
Bob Davies of Central Michigan University says this might be the moment to deal with outstanding issues in higher ed. Also, a high school senior and her dad talk about preserving what's important about college. And Michael Zadorian on the death of the book tour.
I think the whole idea of Facebook Live, Instagram Live, Zoom conversations is really going to become part of the new model after the pandemic.
The Ferndale native reads from his new novel and talks to us about connecting with readers. Those stories and more just ahead on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later this hour, the author who used the funkiest of Ferndale as the backdrop of his latest novel. But first, Michigan's colleges and universities are a key piece of the state's economy. They account for tens of thousands of jobs and are economic drivers in towns like Detroit, Lansing, and Ann Arbor, but also in Flint, Marquette, and Mount Pleasant. With us today is Bob Davies, the president of Central Michigan University, to talk to us about the decisions his school is facing and plans for fall semester. Bob Davies, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much, April. Glad to be here.
Can you tell us how the student body and the staff of CMU are doing?
Well, you know, the new phrase obviously is pivot to remote. CMU has been a leader in distance education for 20-plus years. So in some ways, we've had a little bit of an edge of other universities. It's been a process that has evolved. Has it been perfect? No. But I am extremely proud of the way our faculty, our staff, and our students have really come together, showed great perseverance and determination and grit.
What percentage of instruction was conducted via distance before all this happened?
At our peak, we've had around 10 to 15% of our student population on distance education or through our sites and centers. But even on campus, as of last semester, about 25% of our students would also take online classes, even though they were on our campus.
This is the time of year when prospective students, and maybe also some current ones, are making decisions about fall, whether to enroll, whether to stay enrolled. What have you decided about whether to resume in-person instruction?
Well, right now, our goal is to resume classes on campus, face-to-face. But what we have known as, quote-unquote, face-to-face has significantly changed. It's been reimagined and reinvented, if you will. With regards to the specific decision, we are still awaiting leadership from the state. We are seeking the advice and wisdom from the CDC, statewide health officials, federal health officials, as well as our local officials.
Sure. Well, what are some of the configurations that staff have discussed for practicing distance in lecture halls?
Well, one of the things that we would put forward, if in fact we do go face-to-face, is to ensure that our lecture halls are spaced with social distancing. We would take a look at the deep cleaning that would occur between classes and before and after. Our face-to-face classes would also have a very strong remote element, because we know some faculty may choose for their own health reasons to teach remotely, as well as some students. And so again, when we look at and think about face-to-face, it will be a very different aspect than what we have known in the past.
If classes are observing physical distancing, one assumes that more instructors will be needed. What are you telling faculty and staff about teaching loads for the fall?
Well, one of the key things right now is many of our classes, we're very proud that we have small classes, and that's part of the ethic of Central Michigan University. We will be maintaining those type of teaching loads. We do have some classes that are large, a couple lecture halls that are over 100, and those classes will be broken up into much smaller sections.
Well, does that mean a significant change in budgeting for teaching time that needs to be paid for?
I would say that the budgeting process for all universities is going to be significantly changed, and we will face many challenges through the COVID virus. The teaching loads of professors will have a budget impact, but there are other ones as well. in terms of technology and various other aspects that we all, as you read in the press, are going through.
Yeah. There are some universities that rely on a lot of out-of-state students. I imagine that Central Michigan might not be in the same situation that, say, U of M is in terms of folks coming from out-of-state. But what have you observed already in terms of enrollment numbers as of today? Maybe people are just a little bit less interested in sending their kids or shipping themselves out across state lines for their education.
Well, about 20% of our students come from out of state or international markets, and so our goal is to serve Michigan and the contiguous states primarily. One of the key things, again, is that Central Michigan University is in a less densely populated area. We were the first university, public university, to announce a tuition freeze as part of our announcement to help Michigan is significantly increase our academic scholarships as well as our need-based scholarships, as well as also attracting many more transfer students, again, through robust tuition offers for again, academic as well as need-based. And the other part that we've done as well is deferred the payment for tuition as well as room and board to the last possible moment throughout the semester. Again, doing all of this to support our families, our students, and the state of Michigan.
Have you seen a drop in enrollment for fall?
It's too early to tell at this particular time. We knew through our own demographics as well as various things that our fall enrollment was going to be smaller than the year that we're in. And this was previous COVID-19. But since the rollout of our We Do package in terms of the things I just mentioned, we have actually seen a slight uptick in the number of deposits and students interested in confirming that they would be attending Central Michigan University next year, either as new students, as freshmen, or as transfers. Will we have the largest freshman class next year? No. Will we hit the goal that we set forward pre-COVID? Probably not. But in terms of some of the significant and steep declines other universities are projecting at this particular time, I would say that I'm cautiously and relatively optimistic.
You know, again, CMU is probably not in the same situation as, for example, smaller liberal arts colleges who were quite strapped. You know, being a state school is a different kind of financial model for higher education. But I wanted to ask, how low can enrollment numbers fall for the university to remain viable at the current level of state funding?
Well, now 83 to 85% of our budget actually comes from tuition, which means that it's coming from our students and their families and other resources. 15 to 17% is coming from the state appropriation. We have been extremely financially sound over the last 15 to 20 years. We have a very strong budgeting modeling process. We have what we call a responsible center management process so that it ebbs and flows, ups and downs with enrollment. And so we do have some nimbleness built into our system.
You know, a number of people have talked about this time as the sort of pause that you don't get very often in a generation when we can look at what might be different. Can you think of anything that could or should change because of the terrible pause that COVID-19 has forced us all into?
I think one of the changes that we're seeing at our university is really a new way to look at technology and communication and utilizing it in a very different and more powerful way. I think the blending between online and face-to-face is going to be much more profound and much more magnified than it has been in the past. And again, I think through Central Michigan University, we have sites and centers throughout the entire state, as well as throughout the entire country, that we will be able to see blending those sites and centers within our face-to-face in a much more robust way. I think that there's going to be a great deal of efficiencies created, again, through the use of communication and technology.
You know, technology is certainly exciting, but it's also one of the biggest costs that American universities have faced in the past couple of decades as they have shifted to, you know, more computers for students and more online options. I mean, is that truly something that can, are those costs that can be borne in the course of a pandemic?
I think that there's a lot of different opportunities as well within that. For example, we are on Zoom right now, and that provides us a whole new mechanism to leverage and to work. And so when we think about the structure and the flow of work, I think that will be significantly changed. I think the importance of higher education has actually significantly increased because of the ambiguity and the shifts and the changes and the rapid nature of those changes has brought forward. And a higher education element provides individuals to be in leadership roles for that process. I think one of the changes that higher education will see in of itself is its need to change and be much more nimble and flexible in the way that it operates as well. So I think that the pandemic, if you will, has brought on significant and rapid change. Higher education will be, to be successful, will also have to mimic that same type of rapid and significant change as well.
Could you foresee changes in who's offering classroom instruction?
In terms of different competitors entering the market, that's been happening, and I think that will continue to go. I think that there are many elements in where higher education can also enter into a new space as well to help organizations and corporations in that space.
What about the balance of faculty instructional hours versus staff or lower ranking professors?
I'm not 100% following your question there. Do I think that there will be a different shift in terms of administration and the like?
What I'm asking is whether colleges and universities are going to have to ask more of their staff.
I think we ask a lot of our staff now in many different respects. I think that some of the key things that we do is provide service and the like, and that may actually intensify with the ambiguity and the uncertainty that are in existence and the need to help our students move forward in this process. I think that we will be a smaller staff moving forward due to budget constraints and the like. So from that perspective, yes. But at the same time, there is a culture that we have at many universities, and Central Michigan clearly among them, and is providing resources for our students to continue the process to move forward in the educational moment.
Robert Davies is the president of Central Michigan University. Bob, thank you so much for your time today.
You bet. Have a wonderful day.
Coming up, a graduating high school senior who plans to attend Central in the fall. We'll find out what's on her mind as she thinks about how college might start differently than she expected. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. This part of the season is a key time for families who have college aspirations. Under normal circumstances, they'd be making commitments to colleges and universities, thinking through the plan for financial aid, maybe trying to lock down a living situation. But colleges are still not able to provide a perfectly clear look at what higher education is even going to look like this fall with the presence of COVID-19. Earlier this hour, we heard from Bob Davies, the president of Central Michigan University, that in-person instruction is what he is aspiring to for his school this fall, but a lot of things could change between now and then. How then do families and students make their plans? TJ Buchholz is a parent of two college students, one a current MSU enrollee and one graduating high school senior. He's also the president of Vanguard Public Affairs in Lansing. And Grace Buchholz is the aforementioned high school senior, just graduated from Grand Letch High School, who recently committed to going to Central Michigan. TJ, Grace, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, thanks for having us on the program.
Thank you.
Grace, first of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
How did you decide on Central?
I just thought it would be a better fit for me. Like, I know the campus is a bit smaller than MSU's was, so I thought it would be a better fit.
I understand there's some family history with Central, too.
Yes, there is. I'm a fourth generation. I think my grandpa's parents went, too, and then my dad and my mom both went.
Oh, my gosh. What has it been like wrapping up your high school career basically from home?
We've had a lot of celebrations like on Zoom and stuff. So we did senior Oscars like on a YouTube link. My principal
basically just set out all the Senior Oscar winners and then everyone just joined the link, you know?
Were you up for any Oscars yourself this year?
No, I told my friends not to vote for me.
Why?
Well, all the ones that I wanted, there was like a bunch of other people that were probably more worthy of it than I was.
That's very self-effacing of you, but I think you might be a little quick to undersell what you have to offer, but it's okay. Was there a commencement ceremony for Grand Ledge High School?
They haven't really decided if they're going to still do a face-to-face one or online. So we are really kind of guessing at this point if we're actually going to have a ceremony or not.
TJ, you have a son, Luke, who's a sophomore, right, this year at Michigan State? Did I get that correct?
Yeah, he's actually just finished his sophomore year. So he'll be a junior in the fall.
Oh, my gosh. What would you say his experience has been wrapping up the year with online instruction?
Luke's experience has been terrible. And I say that only because he's in the James Madison College. The classes are difficult. They're difficult when you attend in person. When you are attending, you know, via virtual, for as accommodating as Michigan State is trying to be, there's no substitute for in-person learning, especially for him. So he was very grateful when they offered classes satisfactory, non-satisfactory at Michigan State. And I think they're going to be offering that this summer, and he'll be taking some courses this summer because I think he's gotten used to the format. But generally, it has not been a good experience for him. Nothing on Michigan State. It's just not been a good learning opportunity for him.
We've noticed there have been some college students who say they want their tuition back for the semester because the learning was inadequate or they just felt like they weren't getting the help that they needed. Do you think there are ways that schools might improve on the distance learning model before the fall to make it worthwhile for their students? Or do you have any reservations about Gracie starting college this fall?
Well, I mean, you know, Grace is a very good student. She's, you know, in the National Honor Society. You know, we believe she'll be successful, especially on a campus and the environment that Central Michigan offers for her. I think it's more suited to her learning style. But, you know, I don't know how well she'd do doing, you know, distance for the first semester, only from the perspective of, you know, it's just different. You know, she does very well in person. She's a very hard worker. But, you know, distance learning is not for everybody. And I think that university colleges and universities understand that. And they, you know, I think Central was one of the first schools to offer credit learning to take some of the pressure off students. And, you know, I would hope if they were doing distance learning, they would do that, especially for incoming freshmen who, you know, are going to be brand new to the whole experience in the first place.
Yeah. We did hear from CMU's president that the aspiration is to offer some form of in-person instruction. But how are you feeling about the possibility that we might see some sort of surge in the fall or just any number of factors that might get in the way of the school's ability to do that? As someone who's helping to pay for the tuition, are you okay with the level of uncertainty we have at this moment?
Well, I mean, I'm a former public health communicator as well, and I can tell you that there will likely be a surge before the end of the year in this. I mean, this is not over by any stretch of the imagination. And so, you know, I don't think about it that way. You know, I understand that there is a cost that goes on with higher education, and I'm happy to foot that bill for my children as my parents did for me. But at the same time, you know, I do think that they are doing their best in terms of accommodation. They are trying to make sure that students, you know, get a good experience. You know, I think if possible, you know, the colleges and universities in Michigan, you know, want to have that, you know, the room and board payment to go along with tuition payments, especially, you know, most universities at this stage were kind of struggling financially even before COVID-19. You know, I think there are some schools like the University of Arizona, who I read an article about this morning, they're actually transforming their campus into, you know, dormitories where people have COVID and people don't. They're building an infirmary, they're building other things, they're doing trace testing. And I think you may see a trend line of Michigan universities like Central, like Michigan State, like U of M, for that to happen on campus too, really to accommodate, you know, incoming freshmen and current students on campus, but also to, you know, maintain their fiscal stability as well.
Grace, how about you? What are your hopes for what fall at CMU is going to look like this year? Are you worried that it might not happen?
Yeah, I am worried that we might not be able to have like that hands-on experience that everyone talks about. Like everyone talks about the college experience, like going to the football games, going to the like basketball games or whatever. And for me, I just want to like be on my own from high school. So it's kind of scary not knowing if we're going to go or not.
Mm-hmm. Are there specific things that I think you're a basketball player, right?
Yeah, I was.
What has it been like as a fan and also as an athlete watching athletics get sidelined by the virus?
I was so mad when I found out March Madness was not going to happen. That's literally my favorite time of year for sports. My birthday's in March too, so that was like my favorite month. But to not see sports like happen is just kind of a thing for me. That's like, the coronavirus is serious. If sports aren't really going on, like people aren't making money, the franchises aren't making money, just to show you that like all this is actually real.
I understand you're interested in pursuing an education in sports management.
Correct.
Man, you got to wonder what that's going to look like in years to come.
Yeah, it's very scary, you know, if sports are even going to continue, but I have hope that I'll still be able to do something, hopefully, in basketball.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Grace Buchholz. She just graduated as a senior from Grand Ledge High and is committed to going to Central Michigan. And her father is TJ Buchholz, who also has one MSU student in his household. He's the president of Vanguard Public Affairs in Lansing. You know, as TJ said a minute ago, for a lot of people, the college experience is the things that happen outside of the classroom. There's definitely going to athletic events, but also social interactions and just learning how to maintain your own household and take care of yourself. What is your plan for how you're going to be living? Are you going to try to get in at the dorms or try to commute?
I would like to try to get into the dorms, but in all things, I think my parents will be the decider of that. If they want me to be on campus, if the coronavirus is still real and very heavy at that time. But yeah, I would like to be at the dorms, of course, just to start like my college career off. And I'm not very good at, I'm like a more hands-on learner. So it would kind of be hard for me to start learning college online.
Right.
You know, I would say too, you know, it has not been a picnic here at our house. You know, I have an 18-year-old who is itching to get out on her own and be in a dormitory at the college level. I have another student, you know, who has been on his own for 2 years and has been basically in prison here because we take it seriously in our household. And we have not literally not gone anywhere. We literally have generally been in our home for the past 6 to 7 weeks.
Right.
And so it's been, you know, and our house is not a giant mansion. So, you know, we're on top of one another. So, you know, we have developed these spaces where, you know, we go when we don't want to see each other's faces. I mean, that's a whole thing. But you know, like I said, I'm doing our best to sort of hold our young people down here who would desperately like to be out on their own and making their own decisions and certainly out of the out from under the thumb of their parents. And I would suspect for people that have children our age, that's, I think, the norm. You know, it's certainly cramping, I think, the style of these, you know, sort of young Gen Z people who would like to get their lives started.
I don't mean to talk over your head here, Grace, but TJ, are you worried about your kids getting that adulting experience of, you know, managing their own money and their own shopping and stuff like that?
I'm not really worried about that for my kids. They're fiscally responsible. We've done our best to teach them that. I just think that living on your own, especially when you go to college, it's a lot of trial and error where you learn more about yourself than you learn about the subject that you're studying. It is a really growth opportunity for everyone. And, you know, I really want Grace to be afforded that opportunity. I think for people that go to college, and again, not everybody does, and that's okay. But for people who are aged 18 to 21, those are very formative years that you can miss out on if you can't partake of them. But that being said, you know, I look at the experience versus the value of their lives, and for me, it's, you know, that's an easy decision, you know, for them to keep them as safe as you can, and at the same time getting them into a space where they can, you know, grow up into adults and to live their lives. I mean, it's a tough balance, and we're all struggling with that here, that's for sure.
Grace, had you thought about the possibility of taking a gap year this fall?
I've thought about the possibility of taking classes at our community college, LCC, and if CMU goes on to like online school, but I haven't really thought deep into it. I'm just waiting for Central to decide.
TJ, how does that sit with you? Is it something that's been on your mind as well?
Well, I mean, certainly I think it might be a little bit more cost, you know, more affordable. But at the same time, you know, I think if possible and if it's safe, these colleges and universities want to open their doors and welcome students onto campus. You know, this is something that we're, I think personally, that we're going to be dealing with into 2021. We're going to have waves. I think we're going to be wearing, you know, masks for the foreseeable future. And I think that the universities and colleges that develop strategies to accommodate students and educate them while providing for their health and safety, I think will be successful. And it sounds to me like, you know, most of the universities, at least that I've read in the papers, they are, you know, they're doing their best to try and develop those sort of strategies. You know, Michigan State, for an example, and I think it's very, at this point, fortunate that their president is an MD, you know, who understands, I think, the public health ramifications of that. Certainly in the conversations we'd had with Dr. Davies at CMU, he understands that the balancing act. And I don't believe any college university in this state is going to risk the lives of their students potentially.
TJ, it's not as if parenting college students doesn't involve some stomach acid. Do you feel like you're concerned about where the kids are headed with all this?
Yeah, the only thing I'd say is the university has been pretty communicative with students about you know, what lies ahead, and has not been afraid to say we don't know, we don't have all the answers. That's been good. But you know, they've moved her. She was supposed to find out about her dorm assignment on May 1st, and that's been moved. That deadline's been moved to May 19th. You know, and we've paid all the deposits, and you know what you have to do to get started. Assuming that they'll start in the fall, but you know, I think we'll wait and see. The other thing I'd say too is, and I didn't really address your question, April, about refunds, but we did get a partial refund on my son's room and board, and that came through like just like they said it would. He got the refund like 2 weeks ago. It was, I don't know, it was like $1,300. It was like a third of his room and board.
That's not insubstantial.
I mean, I think they understand that you know, that they've got to provide some relief because they're not providing a full experience. He's going into an apartment next year, an on-campus apartment. So I don't really know what's going to happen with that either, to be honest. It's still very much in limbo, and we're just relying on people to, you know, give us the best guidance they can. And, you know, again, I'm not going to be one of those people that, you know, well, you can't go. I think that as long as you exercise proper precautions, you have to go. I mean, there's not a lot of choice for that. You know, I would hate to see Grace derailed, you know, for a whole year because she couldn't, you know, she couldn't get started in school on time.
Grace, are there things that you can do right now? I mean, so much is on lockdown. You know, it's not like at this point you can make a huge shopping trip to Target or IKEA or somewhere to get furniture for, you know, the place you're going to be living, at least not yet. Are there things that you can do that you feel like might help you feel more like your college experience is beginning?
Yeah, I've been talking to my roommates. I know I'm supposed to have 3 roommates, but one of them I actually went to high school with, and we've been friends since I was in kindergarten. So we've been talking about like our experience and what we're going to do, how we're going to move in. Like, we're not really talking about going to online. We're just keeping our minds open to the fact that we're actually going to have our experience to go to college.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for taking a few minutes to talk to us about this. I know everything's really up in the air right now, but Grace, we're hoping for the best for you.
Thank you.
Grace Buchholz is a recent graduate of Grand Ledge High who's on her way to Central Michigan this fall. And her dad is TJ Buchholz, president of Vanguard Public Affairs in Lansing. Thank you too, TJ.
Thank you so much.
Is this where your head's been lately? Are you or somebody you know considering the options for this fall? Maybe thinking about that gap year, community college? What's your experience been like? Maybe you're considering some of the non-college options like trade schools or sliding right into the workforce. Or you have younger kids and you're just trying to get your head around progressing to the next grade. Drop us a line. You can email stateside@michiganradio.org. We're on Facebook at the Michigan Radio page. Or you can always tweet at us at Stateside Radio. And by the way, if you've been with us through this pandemic and you rely on Stateside and Michigan Radio to keep you in touch with your community and informed about what's happening during a public health crisis, we want you to know that we rely on you, too. As strange and uncertain as the world seems right now, Michigan Radio is here as a constant and consistent voice for you. On this Giving Tuesday, please make a gift to be a constant and consistent source of support for Michigan Radio. You can make a gift at michiganradio.org. And from all of us, thank you. After the break, a novel set in Ferndale circa 2009 takes advantage of a unique community and its characters.
Ferndale has a lot of artists and writers and musicians and public radio people. And, so I kind of wanted to write about them.
That's next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Novelist Michael Zadorian is a medium for a certain kind of Michigander. In books like The Leisure Seeker and Beautiful Music, he revels in characters who may not be living in high style, but who find ways to embrace dysfunction and even build on it as a kind of wayfinder for identity. His latest novel, The Narcissism of Small Differences, brings it back to Zadorian's hometown of Ferndale. Zadorian's doing an online author talk this evening to mark the occasion of the book's publishing. So, Michael, the title of the novel is a psychology concept that's written about in academic circles, but has also been taken up by armchair philosophers like Christopher Hitchens over the years. Why did the narcissism of small differences, why did that concept grab you?
I wound up pitching a bunch of titles to my editor, and I threw that one in there just as kind of an outlier. I thought, I don't think anyone's going to like this one, but I'm going to put it in there anyways because I think it's interesting.
And that was the one you ended up going with.
And that's the one we ended up going with, and there was something about it that just resonated. And, it's not a title that has any direct relevance to the story or anything like that. It just kind of was one of those titles that sort of felt like the book.
At the same time, I mean, I kind of get it. I mean, this is a book about two people who have, on paper, kind of have their adult lives more or less together, but are still sort of plagued by this feeling that something is not quite there. And the narcissism of small differences as a concept is like, when people who don't have a lot of ideological or demographic distance perceive huge differences between them amongst themselves about whether they're really differentiated, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. I think I think that the term comes up in sometimes for explanations for why there are like border wars and things like that. You have people that are practically the exact same people, but you're on that side of the wall or the fence or the whatever, or the country line, but we hate them so much. And it's like, it makes no sense really. And, there's a part in the book where one of the characters, Joe, he kind of makes reference to a book called The Dud Avocado by Elaine Dundy. And it takes place in Paris in the 50s, but she talks about this group of these expat sort of, they're nonconformists. And she mentions that they're so strongly nonconformist that they're practically indistinguishable from each other. And there was something about that. And that's probably the part of the book that makes me feel like, okay, there's the reason for the title right there.
So your main characters are Joe and Anna, a couple who live in Ferndale, which is also where you live. And they're in this period of life where they're sort of stuck. They've been together for more than a decade as a couple. And things start happening. Anna starts a friendship that may be a little bit more than friendly with one of her coworkers. and Joe has developed a habit with online porn that he knows is probably pretty disturbing, but he doesn't quite give up. What did you draw on to find their story, or how did they come to you?
It's interesting. I think I sort of wanted to look at, I don't know, the people, you know, as an adult, you start to realize that, oh, I'm attracted to these kinds of people, or these kinds of people tend to be my friends. And I really started to think about that. And Ferndale is probably, you know, other than Ann Arbor, you know, I think we're probably one of the more sort of, I don't know, whatever, free thinking parts of the, you know, of Michigan, you know, not, you know, no offense to others, but, you know, and, you know, and I realized that, okay, I became interested in just the kind of people that I surrounded myself with. Right. And Ferndale has a lot of artists and writers and musicians and public radio people. And, you know, so I kind of wanted to write about them. And also I was really inspired by a particular artist who used to do that sort of thing, another writer, Dawn Powell, whom we were talking about earlier. I really kind of wanted, she wrote these really just sparkling, super witty, but really, really smart kind of comedies of manners about, she wrote them about the Midwest, but then she moved, you know, but she did a whole series of them about New York, and those were kind of my favorite ones. And it was always a big sort of ensemble of crazy kind of creative types. And I think I took a lot of inspiration from them, or from those books. And that really started to get me thinking about the people I knew and, you know, why we wind up friends with each other, you know, the families we kind of build around ourselves, especially when we don't necessarily have the, you know, traditional type families.
Yeah. Will you read for us from the book?
Sure. This, in this part, Joe has had kind of a tiff with Anna, and he is at a bar. And he runs into a friend of his named Chick. And they have just had Joe and Anna have had a conversation. Anna decides that they are weird. And he tries to convince her that they aren't weird, but that does not, she's not buying it. Anyway, so he's discussing it with his friend Chick later at the bar. Joe raises upper lip. Anna's in one of her moods. She's decided that we're weird. So, what's the news about that? You are weird. Actually, I told her that we're disgustingly normal. There's nothing more normal than being with the same person forever. You're angling for a threesome, aren't you, huh? Bring a little spice in the house? A little strange, huh? Am I right? Joe glared at Chick until he stopped. Sorry, said Chick sheepishly. This happened often. It's been happening more lately. I think it's because she's coming up on her 40th birthday. Chick's eyes widened. Really? I knew you were older than me, but I had no idea you guys were that old. Joe shrugged. Yeah, well, no kids. We're not grossly overweight. Oh, and also age-inappropriate clothing. You'd be surprised how much that helped. So what's the problem? I thought you guys had it whipped. You are the only couple I know that actually seem happy. Us? Really? Yeah, aren't you? No, we're happy, I guess. It's just that sometimes Anna seems to want something. I'm not sure she knows what it is. You sure she doesn't want a kid? No, I don't think that's it. Though Anna had always made it very clear that she wasn't interested in having children, this had still been a recent nightmare of his, that she would suddenly want to become a parent at the age of 40. He had seen a few of those older parents around the neighborhood. They always looked haggard and out of breath. Would you ever want one? Joe shook his head slowly. Nah, I just never felt a calling. Chick took a sip of beer. I don't think men feel it like women do. Men just want to go spread their seed across the land. Probably true, but it seems like you should feel something, even a little. I mean, I know you want a kid, right? Absolutely. There you go. Yeah, but first I have to get someone to put up with me. I mean, come on, who would love me? I'm hideous. Joe laughed and smacked his friend's arm with the back of his hand. Stop saying that. You're not hideous. I'm going to die alone. You know it. I know it. Yeah, you're probably right. Chick shot him a look, then sighed loudly and took a sip of his beer. Going to the tiki thing? He said after a long silence. Who knows? That's months away. Spring may never come to Michigan. They're just going to find us all preserved in a giant ice floe 1,000 years from now. Joe sighed. Probably. How about you? Sure, I'm going. I got nothing else to do. I told you, I have no life. Chick downed the rest of his beer, stood up, and laid a 5 on the bar. Ah, well, I'm going to head home. They're showing Kiss Me Deadly on Turner Classics. Oh, that's such a good movie. Maybe I'll do the same. You're welcome to come by. It's like, nah, I should get home. Chick creased his forehead, pursed his lips, and nodded. Yeah, that would be less weird. Joe shook his head. You son of a bee. Way to use information spoken in confidence against me. Chick smiled. Next time you'll know better. He raised his hand and headed to the door. And just then, the turn of the conversation made Joe wonder about his life. While he was going to tiki parties or concerts or indie films or DIY craft fairs or gallery openings, most people his age were concerned with things like their kids' soccer games and parent-teacher conferences. Their children ate up their lives. He did not know much about parenting, but he knew that it was really hard work. Most parents, he felt, were just trying to survive. Someone at the paper had once said to him, "If my kids are alive at the end of the day, I feel like I've done my job." It seemed like he knew so many parents who had given up what they had really wanted to do in order to provide for their children. The fact that they didn't mind that enormous sacrifice was amazing to Joe, even admirable. Yet it wasn't what he wanted for himself.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Zadorian, and he just read to us from The Narcissism of Small Differences, the new book that just published. Michael, there are some, this reminds me of some writers like Tom Perata, who managed to capture something in the everyday and show us what's much bigger about it. What's difficult about that kind of writing about people in that way?
You know, well, that's really interesting because it does, when people talk about my work, they do often say things like that. And I never really, I don't know, I don't really think of it or at least intentionally try to write in that manner. But I guess I do tend to write about the mundane a lot. And, so it's just always been something that, I don't know, those are the things that resonate for me. When I just walking around the world, I always have like a little notebook, and sometimes someone will just say something or I'll notice somebody do something strange, and it just clicks with me, and I feel like, all right, that is something there. And you know, and often they're really mundane things, but they just resonate with me in some way. So I think that's what I wind up drawing on when I sit down to write.
Is there anything that you think is particularly difficult about catching people in those moments?
You know, I don't know if there's anything difficult about it. It's sometimes, I think, just a matter of recognizing them. And I have that notebook, and sometimes it's anything. Someone will say something funny or interesting or strange, or they'll tell me about someone they know who did something, you know, odd. Like a friend of mine, he said, "Oh, I had my friend, I think I'll change his name. We'll call him Ed." And he always used to have a jar of urine in his car. And it would roll around the back seat. And it's like, that's a really strange thing to, you know, to just have that. And there's so many reasons. There's so many different reasons why you could have that that jar of urine rolling around on the floor of your car. But there's something really strange and evocative about that.
Well, I'm guessing Ed has an aversion to stopping to use convenience store facilities.
Maybe, you know, but he did get to, he was later known as Ed the P-Jar Man.
That passage that we just heard is one of the more perceptive takes I've heard on parenthood from the non-parent perspective. It's funny because usually when we see novels that are about people coming to terms with their life choices, they are written from the perspective of people who had families and you know, are sort of second guessing the circumstances that got them there. But this is sort of a turnaround on that.
And it was important to me to talk about that. I just felt like it was one of the things that I could, one of the sort of different elements of this sort of story, which that could be different. So I wanted to represent that sort of whatever child-free couple. But I also didn't want to do it at the cost of, you know, some sort of, you know, what jauntist eye at parenthood either.
Yeah. This book was written under very different circumstances than what we're all living in right now. In fact, I think it was written a couple of years ago, wasn't it?
The book takes place in Detroit in 2009. And that was pretty much when I wrote it. I wrote it and started it in probably 2007. And
right on the cusp of the recession.
Yeah, exactly. And that became part of the, you know, definitely part of the book, the whole Detroit mentality of you're lucky you even have a job, because times were really bad in 2009. Mm-hmm. And anyways, I wrote it. I was really happy with it. I got nothing but praise from editors, but nobody wanted it. And, you know, and I, in retrospect, I wonder if it had to do with Detroit and the idea of a kind of comedy of manners or whatever taking place in Detroit. I think to a lot of editors seemed perverse almost, you know, and anyways, it went nowhere. And I wound up putting it in a, you know, a drawer and but I didn't forget about it. And, anyways, I got my last book published, Beautiful Music, and I mentioned this book to my editor at Akashic, and he said, yeah, I'd like to see that.
Joe and Anna, like, it's despite the fact that they're set in 2009, it's kind of funny that the two of them are sort of alone together, at least in trying to figure out their relationship. How do you imagine them in the present? Maybe what they went on to after the book leaves off.
You mean during the pandemic?
Yeah.
You know something? I think I don't know. I think they'd be okay. I think they would. Maybe they'd have gotten a bigger place by then, because sometimes a small townhouse can be really small if you're.
As people are learning right now.
Mm-hmm. Right. I can't even imagine being in one of those tiny New York apartments that most New Yorkers live in. Yeah, I think it is interesting to have the book come out right now, and I mean it's why we're talking, you know, over Zoom. You know, I mean, the literary model of marketing, you know, author marketing is so outmoded in many ways. And, you know, it's no fun to drive 5 hours and have four people show up at your bookstore event. I mean, there's always lots of other value attached to showing up at a bookstore and signing books or whatever. But it's in many ways, it's highly flawed. And so I think the whole idea of Facebook Live, Instagram Live, Zoom conversations is really going to become part of the new model after the pandemic, because I think we're all just realizing that this is in some ways easier, in some ways more difficult, at least technically sometimes, but we're all just doing the best we can and making it up as we go along and, you know, hoping for the best, really.
Michael Zadorian's new novel is The Narcissism of Small Differences, and he's going to be doing a Facebook Live event tonight where he'll read a little bit from the book and also take people's questions. We'll have a link up on our website. Michael, good talking with you. Hang in there.
Thank you. You too, April. Take care.
That's it for Stateside today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll catch up with you tomorrow.